King to Lebanon. Qasi, now quite docile, and three of his officers were led to the jail as the Star of David was raised over the fort. Ari took the rest of the men down the road to where David had set the ambush. They were ready for the final phase of the end of Abu Yashar as an Arab base. The people of Abu Yashar had seen and heard the fighting. They knew, surely, their village was next. Ari sent a truce team in to give those who were left 20 minutes to evacuate or face the consequences. From his vantage point, he could see many of his lifelong friends trudging out of Abu Yashar toward the hills of Lebanon. Ari felt sick in his stomach as he saw them go. A half hour passed, and then an hour.
"We had better start," David said to him.
I want to make sure they are all out."
"No one has left for a half hour, Ari. Everyone is out who is coming out."
Ari turned and walked away from his waiting troops. David followed him.
"I'll take command," David said.
"All right," Ari whispered.
Ari stood alone on the mountainside as David led the men down to the saddle in the hill where Abu Yashar nestled. He was pale as he heard the first sounds of gunfire. David deployed the men as they approached the outskirts. A clatter of machine gun and small arms fire went up. The Jews dropped and crawled forward in a squad-by-squad advance. Inside Abu Yashar, 100 Arabs led by Taha had chosen to make a determined stand. The fight for the village was a rare situation for this war. The Jews had superior numbers of men and arms. A withering barrage of automatic fire was followed by a rain of grenades on the forward Arab positions. The first Arab machine gun was knocked out, and as the defenders fell back, the Jews gained a foothold in the town itself. David Ben-Ami conducted the battle by sending out patrols to move street by street, house by house, to clean out pockets of resistance. The going was slow and bloody. These were houses built of stone, not mud, and those who remained fought it out hand to hand. The day wore on. Ari ben Kanan did not move from his position on the mountainside. The constant sound of gunfire and the bursts of grenades, and even the screams of men, reached his ears. The Arabs of Abu Yashar fell back from position after position as the relentless attack cut off any coordination between groups or individuals. Finally, all those left were squeezed into one street on the edge of town. More than 75 Arabs had been killed fighting to the end in the most dramatic defense the Arabs had made of one of their villages. It was a tragic fight. Neither the Jews nor the Arabs wanted it. The last 8 men were pushed into the last stronghold, the fine stone house of the Mukhtar, which stood near the stream across from the mosque. David called for the Davidka. The house was blown to pieces. The last 8 men, including Taha, were killed. It was nearly dark when David Ben-Ami walked up the road to Ari. David was battle-weary.
"It is all over," David said.
Ari looked at him glassy-eyed, but did not speak.
"There were nearly 100 of them. All dead. We lost 14 boys, 3 girls. Another dozen wounded are up at Gandafna."
Ari did not seem to hear him. He started to walk down the hill toward the village.
"What is going to become of their fields?" Ari whispered.
"What will become of them? Where will they go?"
David grabbed Ari's shoulder.
"Don't go down there, Ari."
Ari looked at the little sea of flat roofs. It was so quiet.
"Is the house by the stream?"
"No,"
David said.
"Try to remember it as it was."
"What will become of them?" Ari said. They are my friends. We are waiting for the order, Ari.
Ari looked at David and blinked his eyes and shook his head slowly.
I must give it then, David said.
No, Ari whispered. I shall give it.
He looked at the village for the last time.
Destroy Abu Yasha, Ari said.
Chapter 12. David slept in Yordana's arms. She held his head tightly against her breast. She could not sleep. Her eyes were wide, staring into the darkness. Ari had given her leave from Gandafna so the two of them could travel to Tel Aviv together and have a weekend alone. After tomorrow, the Lord only knew how long it would be before she saw him again, if ever. Yordana had known in her heart all along that David would volunteer for such a mission. Since the beginning of the siege, he had been eating his heart out for Jerusalem. She saw that distant look of sadness and pain each time she looked into his eyes. He stirred in his sleep. She kissed his forehead gently and ran her fingers through his hair, and he smiled in his sleep and became still once more. It would not be right for a Sabra girl to tell her lover she was ill with worry for him. She must only smile and encourage him and conceal the fear in her heart. She felt weak with apprehension, and she pressed him close to her body and wanted to hold him for a night without end. It had begun the day partition was voted. The next day, the Higher Arab Committee called for a general strike, which erupted into the savage burning and plunder of the Jewish commercial center of Jerusalem. While the Arab mobs ran wild, British troops stood by. The siege of the city began almost immediately, with Abdul Qadar using Arab villages along the highway to blockade the Jewish convoys from Tel Aviv. While the titanic battles in the corridor raged for the Heights, the Castle, and the other villages, the Jews in Jerusalem were frozen, hungry, and thirsty, and under direct cannonading from Kawukji and Qadar. While the Palmach hillmen fought to keep the road open, the Yishuv organized the convoys which slugged their way along the Bab el-Wad until the Judean hills were littered with wreckage. Inside the city, the fighting started with bombings and ambushes and erupted into full-scale war. The Haganah cleared a huge field of fire from King David Hotel to the old city wall where the irregulars massed, and the wreckage was called Bevingrad. The commander of the Haganah in Jerusalem was saddled with problems beyond mere military matters. He was burdened by a huge civilian population that had to be fed and protected in a situation of siege. He was further burdened by the fact that a large part of his population, ultra-Orthodox and fanatical Jews, not only refused to fight, but obstructed the efforts of the Haganah to protect them. In ancient Israel, the commander of Jerusalem had been plagued by the same problems. In the siege against the Romans, the fall of Jerusalem was hastened by a division of strength by the Zealots, and it led to a Roman massacre of 600,000 Jews. On that occasion, the Jews had held out against the Romans for 3 years. It was unlikely that they could do it again. In addition to the problem of the ultra-Orthodox and fanatics who refused to fight, the Maccabees only cooperated part of the time and were frequently concerned with carrying on a private war. When they did support the Haganah, it was not with particular distinction. The Hillmen Brigade of the Palmach was overextended and overworked in the Judean hills and quite reluctant to take orders from the Haganah commander of Jerusalem. It added up to a desperate situation in which the Haganah commander could do no right. Beautiful Jerusalem became battle-scarred and bloody. The Egyptians attacked from the south and shelled the city and bombed it from the sky. The Arab Legion used the sacred walls of the old city as a stockade. Casualties mounted to the thousands. Again, uncommon valor and ingenuity were the keynotes of the Jews' defense. Again, the Davidka mortar did yeoman's work. It was moved from place to place to make the Arabs think there were many of them. Outside Jerusalem, when the Arab Legion took Latrun Fort, they promised to keep the water pumping station open so that the civilian population would have enough to drink. Instead, the Arabs blew up the pumping station and cut off the water supply. Cisterns 2,000 and 3,000 years old were known to exist under Jerusalem. The Jews located them, tore the covers from them, and discovered that, as if by a miracle, they still held water. Until emergency pipelines could be built, these ancient cisterns were all that kept the Jews from dying of thirst. The days passed into weeks, and the weeks into months, and still Jerusalem held out. Every home became a battlefield. Men, women, children, daily girded to battle with a spirit of defiance that would never be conquered. David Ben-Ami's heart ached for Jerusalem. The siege was on his mind all day and all night. He opened his eyes.
"Why aren't you sleeping?" he asked Jordana. "I have enough time for sleeping when I am away from you," she answered.
He kissed her and told her that he loved her.
"Oh, David, my David."
She wanted to beg him not to ask for this mission. She wanted to cry out and tell him that if anything happened to him, there could be no life for her. But she held her tongue, as she knew she must. One of his 6 brothers had died at kibbutz near him, fighting the Egyptians, and another was dying from wounds received in a convoy to relieve besieged Negba in the Negev desert. David's brother Nahum of the Maccabees had chosen to go into the old city. David heard the rapid beating of Jordana's heart.
"David, love me. Love me," she pleaded.
In the old city of Jerusalem, the Arab mobs surged in behind the legion to destroy a score of synagogues and holy places, and they pillaged and looted every Jewish house that fell. The pious ones and their Haganah and Maccabee defenders were squeezed back and back until they held only 2 buildings, one of them the Herva Synagogue. It could only be a matter of days before they were all wiped out. Jordana was awakened by the light of day. She stretched and purred with contentment, for her body was pleased with love. She reached out for David. He was not there. Her eyes opened with alarm, and then she saw him standing over her. David, for the first time, was dressed in the uniform of the Army of Israel. She smiled and lay back on the pillows, and he knelt beside her and touched her hair, which was a scarlet disarray.
"I have been watching you for an hour. You are very beautiful when you sleep," he said.
She reached out and opened her arms and drew him close and kissed him.
"Shalom, Major Ben-Ami,"
she whispered in his ear and kissed it softly.
"Darling, it's late. I have to be going," he said.
"I'll get dressed right away," she said.
"Why don't I just go right now by myself? I think it will be better this way."
Jordana felt her heart stop. For a fraction of a second, she meant to seize him. Then she quickly masked her shock and smiled.
"Of course, darling," she said.
"Jordana, Jordana, I love you."
"Shalom, David. Go quickly, please."
She turned her face to the wall and felt his kiss on her cheek. And then she heard the door closing.
"David, David," she whispered. Please come back to me.
Avedan drove with Major Ben-Ami to the flat that Benzion, the chief of operations, kept near headquarters. General Benzion, a man of 31, was also a Jerusalemite. His aide, Major Alterman, was present when they arrived. They exchanged greetings and condolences for the death of David's brother at Nirim.
Avedan tells us you have something of interest, Alterman said.
Yes, David answered slowly. Ever since the partition vote, the lament of the exiles has been running through my mind night and day. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem.
Benzion nodded. He shared David's feeling for Jerusalem. His wife, his children, and his parents were there. David continued.
We control the road fairly well up to Latrun. Beyond Latrun, in the Bab el Wad, the Palmach had cleared most of the heights.
We all know that Latrun is our greatest stumbling block, Alterman said crisply. Hear him out, Benzion snapped.
I have been thinking. I know that area around Latrun like my mother's smile. I have been going over the ground in my mind, inch by inch, for nearly 6 months. I'm absolutely certain Latrun can be bypassed.
There was a stunned silence for a moment.
Just what do you mean? Benzion asked.
If you draw an arc around Latrun from road to road, it is 16 kilometers.
But this 16 kilometers is merely a line on the map. There is no road. Those hills are wild and impassable.
There is a road, David said.
David, what on earth are you talking about? Avedan demanded.
Over part of the way there is an ancient Roman road. It is 2,000 years old, and it is completely covered by brush and slide and washout. But it is there. The bed runs through the wadis for about 8 kilometers. I know as surely as I stand here that I can follow the wadis for the balance of the distance.
David walked to the wall map and drew a semicircle around Latrun, linking the roads. Avedan and Benzion stared for several moments. Alterman looked cynical. Avedan, who had already heard some of the plans from Ari Ben Canaan, was critical.
David, Avedan said coldly, say you are able to find this alleged Roman road, and suppose you are able to find a goat path through the wadis. What then? You are still a long, long way from relieving the siege of Jerusalem.
What I propose, David said without hesitation, is that we build another road atop the Roman road and eliminate the need for capturing Latrun by going around it.
Come now, David, Benzion said. According to the route you have drawn on the map, we will have to build this road right under the noses of the Arab Legion at Latrun.
Exactly, David said. We don't need much more than a trail, just enough to accommodate the width of a single truck. Joshua made the sun stand still at Latrun. Perhaps we can make the knights stand still. If one task force builds from the Jerusalem end and another from Tel Aviv, and we work quietly by night, I know we can complete the bypass in a month. As for the Arab Legion, you know damned well that Glub won't bring them out of Latrun to fight. He is keeping them where they are safe from open battle.
We aren't so sure of that, Alterman said. He may fight for the road.
If Glub wasn't afraid of committing the Legion to battle, then why hasn't he attacked from the triangle and tried to cut Israel in half?
It was a question no one could answer. It could only be assumed that David was right. The opinion of the staff was that Glub was overextended and had no intention of fighting beyond the areas of Jerusalem, the corridor, and Latrun. Besides, the Israelis would welcome the chance to meet the Legion in the field. Benzion and Avedan sat quietly and mulled over David's proposal.
What do you want? Benzion said at last.
Give me a jeep and one night to drive through.
Avedan was worried. In the early days of Haganah, It pained him every time he drew a casualty. It was like losing a son or daughter. In a small, close-knit community like the old Yeshuv, each loss was a personal tragedy. Now, with the war, the Jews had casualties in the thousands, and for a small country it was a devastating number. Most of them were the cream of the nation's youth, men and women. No nation, no matter how large or small, had David Ben-Ami's to spare, Avidan thought. It seemed like a suicide task that David was taking upon himself. Maybe David only thought he knew of a route into Jerusalem because he wanted to believe that one existed.
A jeep and 24 hours, David pleaded.
Avidan looked at Ben-Zion. Alterman shook his head. What David wanted to do was impossible. The burden of Jerusalem weighed every heart. It was the life beat, the very breath of Judaism. Yet, Ben-Zion wondered if it had not been madness to try to hold the city from the very beginning. David's parents had suffered enough, Avidan thought. One brother dead and another wounded, and a third the leader of the Maccabees' suicide squad inside the old city walls. David looked from one to the other frantically.
"You must give me a chance," he cried.
There was a knock on the door. Alterman took a communique and handed it to Ben-Zion. The blood drained from the face of the operations chief. He handed the paper to Avidan. None of them remembered Avidan's ever losing his composure. But now his hand trembled as he read, and tears welled in his eyes. His voice quivered.
"The old city has just surrendered."
"No!"
Alterman cried. David sagged into a chair. Ben-Zion's fists clenched and he gritted his teeth.
"Without Jerusalem there is no Jewish nation," he cried.
He turned to David.
"Go up to Jerusalem, David. Go up."
When Moses led the tribes of Israel to the shores of the Red Sea, he asked for a man with such faith in the power of God that he would be the first to jump into the sea. Nachshon was the name of the man who came forward. Nachshon became the code name of David Ben-Ami's venture. At darkness, David left the town of Rehovot, south of Tel Aviv, and drove toward Judea. At the foothills, near Latrun, David turned off the road into the wilderness, into the steep, rock-filled hills and the gorges and wadis. David Ben-Ami was driven by an obsession, but his passion was tempered by his appreciation of the gravity of the mission and controlled by his infinite knowledge of the land around him. The jeep twisted and banged and rebelled against the torture which no mechanical thing was made to take. In compound low gear, David drove slowly and cautiously as he came very close to Latrun. The danger of meeting a Legion patrol was great. His eyes and instincts sharpened as he saw the fort in the distance. He inched the vehicle down a treacherous slope in search of the Roman road buried under centuries of debris. He followed the contours of washed-down dirt and rocks, and at the junction of two wadis, he stopped and dug up some rocks. Their size and texture assured him that the road was there. Once he had established the general direction of the pathway of Roman legions, he was able to move along it more quickly. David Ben-Ami swept in a circle around Latrun, pushing himself and his vehicle without mercy. Many times he cut the motor and sat in frozen silence to listen for an imagined enemy sound. Many times he crawled on his belly in the darkness to feel out the route through the dry, rocky wadis. Those 16 kilometers were the longest David had ever known. The night passed too quickly for him, and with its passing, the danger of an Arab patrol increased. At dawn, Ben-Zion and Avidan were drowsy from a night of waiting and filled with apprehension. They now knew the folly of David's attempt. They felt in their hearts that they would never see him again. The phone rang. Avedon lifted the receiver and listened.
It is the coding room, Avedon said. They have just received a message from Jerusalem.
What is it?
I-358.
They dashed for the Bible. Ben-Zion emitted a long sigh of relief as he read, Isaiah 35:8. And an highway shall be there. No lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon, but the redeemed shall walk there. Nachshon had arrived in Jerusalem. David Ben-Ami had found a bypass of Latrun. Jerusalem still had a chance. Thousands of volunteers in Jerusalem were sworn to secrecy. They poured out of the city to claw a road through the wilderness along the route that David had found. David returned to Tel Aviv, where a second corps of volunteers worked at the opposite end to link up with the Jerusalem people. The two task forces hid by day and built by night, right under the noses of the Arab Legion at Latrun. They toiled in feverish silence, carrying away by hand each bag full of dirt. Through the wadis and ravines, along the ancient Roman road, the two forces inched toward each other. David Ben-Ami asked for permanent transfer to Jerusalem, and got it. Jordana had had a case of nerves ever since she had left David in Tel Aviv. She returned to Gandafna, where there was a tremendous amount of work to be done rebuilding the wrecked village. Most of the buildings had been hit by artillery fire. The younger children, who had been evacuated, were now returned. Kitty's cottage had not been too severely damaged, so Jordana moved in with her and Karen. The two women had developed a fast friendship. Jordana found herself able to confide in Kitty the things which she could not tell others for fear of showing weakness. Kitty was fully aware of Jordana's state when she returned from Tel Aviv, though Jordana tried to mask it with an outward show of gruffness. On an evening 2 weeks after she had parted from David, she sat with Kitty in the dining room, having a late snack and tea. As Kitty chatted, Jordana suddenly became pale and stood up quickly and ran from the room. Kitty followed her outside and reached her just as Jordana slumped to the ground. Kitty caught her and supported her, half leading and half carrying Jordana to her office. She stretched the Sabra on the cot and forced some brandy into her. It was 10 minutes before Jordana came fully around. She sat up in a daze. Kitty made her put her head down. When she had regained her senses, Jordana shook her head with disbelief.
"What happened?" Kitty asked. "I don't know. Nothing like that has ever happened to me. I was listening to you, and all of a sudden I couldn't hear you or see you. It turned dark, and a cold chill passed through me. Go on." I heard David shriek. It was horrible. Now you listen to me, young lady. You've been so tensed up you're ready to explode. I want you to take a few days' rest. Go down to Yad El with your mother."
Jordana sprang to her feet.
"No," she said. "Sit down," Kitty barked. "It's nonsense. I am behaving shamefully. You are acting quite normally. You wouldn't get yourself into such a state if you would let off a little steam and a few tears occasionally, and not try to hold it all inside you. David would be so disgusted with me if he knew I was carrying on so. Oh, stop it, Jordana. Damn your Sabra pride. I'm giving you a sedative, and I want you to go right to bed."
"No,"
Jordana said, and ran from the room. Kitty gave a sigh of resignation. What did you do with a girl who felt that any show of emotion would be construed as a weakness? Years of tension and struggle had built a thick skin on the Sabras. Their pride was fierce beyond comprehension. 3 days after the incident, Kitty came into her cottage one evening after sending Karen over to Dov's. Jordana was working on reports. Kitty sat down before the desk. Jordana looked up and smiled, then turned grave as she saw the expression on Kitty's face. Kitty took the pen from her hand. Neither of them spoke for several moments.
David is dead,
Jordana said.
Yes. How did it happen?
Jordana said in an emotionless monotone.
Ari phoned a few minutes ago. The details are not clear. It seems that he organized a band of some Palmach, some Maccabees, some Haganah. It was not authorized. Apparently David had been looking at the walls of the old city, and it was more than he could stand. They made an attack to try to win back the old city. They conquered Mount Zion.
Go on, Jordana said.
They didn't have a chance. It was a suicide mission.
Jordana did not move or even blink her eyes.
What can I do? What can I say?
Kitty said. The girl stood up and held her chin high.
Don't worry about me, she said in a clear voice.
If Jordana Ben-Kanan had tears for her David, no one ever saw them. She disappeared with her grief into the ruins of Abu Yishah. She sat neither moving nor eating nor drinking for 4 days and 4 nights. She returned to Gandafna. As Ari had done with his sweetheart, Jordana never mentioned David's name again. One night, a month from the time David Ben-Ami found the way to Jerusalem, the Burma Road, the bypass of Latrun, was completed. A convoy rushed through, and the siege of Jerusalem was over for all time. Until that moment, no one had known for certain if Israel would live. In the magic instant when the workers from Jerusalem shook hands with the workers from Tel Aviv, the Jews had won their war of liberation. Chapter 13. There were many months of the bitterest and most bloody fighting ahead, but the opening of the Burma Road gave the Jews a spiritual lift at a time it was sorely needed. After the Jews had stopped the first invasion of the Arab armies, the Security Council of the United Nations was able to effect a temporary truce. Both sides welcomed it. The Arabs obviously had to shake up their commands and reorganize. They had lost face in the eyes of the world by failure to overrun the country. The Israelis wanted the time to get in more weapons and increase their operational strength. The provisional government did not have complete control of the situation, for the cooperation of the Palmach, the ultra-Orthodox, and the Maccabees was still a matter of degrees. The Palmach, to their credit, gave up their elite corps and joined the Army of Israel en masse when faced with expulsion from the fighting fronts for failure to take orders from the central command. The Maccabees likewise made up special Maccabee battalions in the Israeli army, but insisted on their own officers. But nothing could change the unyielding attitude of the fanatics, who continued to wait for the Messiah in an absolute literal interpretation of the Bible. Just as unification of these elements appeared a reality, a tragic event occurred to alienate the Maccabees forever. Maccabee sympathizers in America had purchased a large amount of needed arms and a cargo plane, which was named the Akiva. Along with the arms, they had several hundred volunteers ready to join the special Maccabee battalions. Under truce conditions, neither side was supposed to rearm nor reinforce any position. Both Arabs and Jews ignored this UN dictate. Both sides secretly moved arms and men around in their buildups of strength. The existence of the Akiva became known by Israeli people in Europe. The provisional government demanded that the Akiva and its arms be turned over to it. Israel was one nation now, fighting a single war, they argued, and, after all, the Maccabee battalions were part of the Army of Israel. The Maccabees objected. They wanted to keep their identification, and they argued that the arms were specifically purchased for use of their members. The government brought up the question of violation of the truce. If the provisional government handled the entry of the Akiva, The chances of getting the arms in secretly were 100% better than if the Maccabees tried on their own. The Maccabees countered by claiming that they did not have to recognize the truce order, for they were independent of a central command. So the bitter squabble raged, with the provisional government asserting that there could be but one central authority, and the Maccabees claiming otherwise. The Akiva took off from Europe with its first load of arms and volunteers. The government, which sorely needed both the arms and the men, was forced to order the Maccabees to make the plane return without landing. The Maccabees were enraged at this order. As the Akiva reached Palestine, in defiance of the edict, the airdrome was filled with government officials, Maccabees, and United Nations observers. The government radioed the plane a final warning to return to Europe. The Akiva refused. The provisional government ordered fighter planes up, and the Akiva was shot down. Fighting erupted between army and Maccabee troops. In anger, the Maccabees withdrew their battalions from the army. Both sides hurled names and charges and countercharges until all justice in the Akiva incident was buried under a welter of insults and accusations. The bitterness created in Maccabee ranks was permanent. The incident did prove to be a final clearing of the air. During the years of the British Mandate, the Maccabees had been a factor in making the British quit by their constant goading. Once the British were gone, terror tactics lost their usefulness, and the Maccabees appeared unable to accept the discipline that a field army required. Thus, their value as a fighting force was seriously qualified. Their one great victory had been at Jaffa, a city of crushed morale. In other places, they had failed. Their massacre at the village of Neve Sadij remained as the one great black mark against the Jews. The Maccabees were activists with great individual courage, but by their very nature they rebelled against authority. After the Akiva incident, they remained as an angry, defiant political group whose basic tenet was that force conquered all problems. For a month, talks went on with both sides. Count Bernadotte and his American aide, Ralph Bunch, working for the United Nations, were unable to bring the sides together. They could not break down in a month what had been building for 3 decades. Kawukji, in central Galilee, had been constantly violating the truce. Now the Egyptians broke faith by resuming fighting before the truce deadline was up. It was a great mistake, for it triggered a new Israeli campaign. If the world's military experts had been amazed by the ability of the Jews to withstand the invasion, they were stunned as the army of Israel went on the offensive. The new phase of the war opened with the Israel Air Force bombing Cairo, Damascus, and Amman as a warning for the Arabs to quit similar attacks on Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The Arabs did not bomb Jewish cities from the air again. Israeli corvettes carried the fight to the enemy by shelling Tyre in Lebanon, one of the key ports for the entry of arms. At Ein Gev Kibbutz on the Sea of Galilee, the farmers who had been under siege for months and who had broken a Syrian attack now struck back. In a bold night maneuver, they climbed the Susita mountain and threw the Syrians from it. In the central Galilee, Ari ben Kanan went after Kawukji and Nazareth. By pushing his troops to the limit of their endurance and by making brilliant use of his equipment, he completely outmaneuvered and outfought the irregulars. The Mufti's personal general took a sound licking and lost Nazareth. With the fall of Nazareth, the hostile Arab villages in the central Galilee collapsed, and Kawukji led a flight to the Lebanese border. The Israelis commanded the entire Galilee and all its roads. In the Bab el-Wad and the Jerusalem corridor, the Hillmen Brigade widened the way and began moving south toward Bethlehem. In the Negev Desert, the Israelis held the Egyptians in a stalemate. Samson once set fire to the tails of 1,000 foxes and turned them loose on the Philistine fields. Now, lightning jeep units with machine guns, called Samson's foxes, made fierce attacks on Egyptian supply lines and Arab villages. The terrible siege of Negba Kibbutz was lifted. It was in the Sharon Valley, facing the triangle, that the Israelis scored their most spectacular success. Using the jeep units to the fullest and led by the former Hanita Brigade of the Palmach, the Jews swept into Lydda and Ramla, Arab towns that had harassed the road to Jerusalem. They captured the Lydda airdrome, the largest field in Palestine, and then swung into the Samarian Triangle to develop a maneuver to encircle Latrun. On the way, they brushed aside the Iraqi forces and relieved the siege of another children's village, Ben Shemen. Just as encirclement of Latrun was near accomplishment, the Arabs, in unison, screamed for a second truce. All the Israeli victories had been scored in 10 days. As Bernadotte and Bunch conducted the second truce talks, the Arab world was frantic. Abdullah of Transjordan was the first to see the handwriting on the wall. He went into secret negotiations with the provisional government and agreed to keep the legion sitting and out of action. This would permit the Jews to turn their full attention to the Egyptians. In exchange, the Jews agreed not to go after the old city or the legion-dominated Samarian triangle. Again, the brigand Kawukji broke the truce by attacking from Lebanon. As the second truce ended, Operation Hiram, named for the Lebanese king in the Bible, blew Kawukji and the Mufti's dreams into smoke once and for all. The Israeli army swept over the Lebanese border on the heels of the shattered and fleeing irregulars. Lebanese villages showed an array of white flags of surrender. With Kawukji banished, the Jews pulled back to their own borders, although there had been little to stop them from going clear to Beirut and Damascus. With the Galilee clear, the Sharon quiet, and a promise to Abdullah not to attack Jordan-held positions, the army turned its full attention on the Egyptians. Meanwhile, the Arab world scrambled to explain away the series of Israeli successes. Abdullah of Transjordan publicly blamed Iraq for the Arab failure. Iraq had failed to attack from the triangle to cut the Jews in half, and had generally made themselves look ridiculous. Iraq, which dreamed of ruling a greater Arab nation in its Fertile Crescent scheme, blamed their overextended supply lines. The Syrians were the most vocal of all. They blamed the Americans and Western imperialism. The Saudi Arabians, who fought in the Egyptian army, blamed nearly everyone, each Arab country in turn. The Egyptians blamed Transjordan for selling out by Abdullah's agreement with the Jews. However, one of the most spectacular byproducts of the War of Liberation was the manner in which the Egyptian press and radio translated Egyptian disasters as victories. So far as the Egyptian public was concerned, their troops were winning the war. The Lebanese and the Yemenites kept very quiet. They were not too interested in the fighting to begin with. The myth of Arab unity exploded as the Jews continued to administer defeats on the combined Arab strength. The former kisses, handshakes, and vows of eternal brotherhood changed to knife-pulling, haranguing, and finally, political assassination. Abdullah was eventually murdered by Muslim fanatics as he came from prayer in the Mosque of Omar in the Old City. Farouk was thrown out of Egypt by a clique of militarists who spoke the pages of an Arab Mein Kampf. Intrigue and murder, the old Arab game, raged at full force. In the Negev Desert, the Army of Israel, now balanced and coordinated, brought the war into its closing stages. Suwaiden, the monster on the hill which had tormented the Negba kibbutz, fell. It was at Suwaiden that the Egyptians showed their greatest valor. A bypassed Egyptian pocket at Fallujah, which had been under Jewish siege, was later evacuated under truce talks. One of its Egyptian officers was a young captain later to lead the overthrow of Farouk. His name was Gamal Abdel Nasser. The pride of the Egyptian Navy, the cruiser Farouk, had tried to shell a Jewish position a few hours before one of the truces to gain a tactical advantage. It was sunk by Israeli motorboats filled with dynamite, which were driven out in the water, set, and rammed into the cruiser's sides. Beersheba, the Seven Wells, the city of Father Abraham, fell in the autumn of 1948 to a surprise Israeli attack. The Egyptians dug in and built a deep and stacked defense for a stand below Beersheba. The defenses seemed impenetrable. Again, the Jews called upon their intimate knowledge of the land. They found a Nabataean path, thousands of years old, which allowed them to encircle the Egyptian defenses and attack from the rear. From then on, it was a rout. The army of Israel lashed out after the fleeing Egyptians. They bypassed the Gaza area and crossed into the Sinai itself. The Lord has mingled a spirit of perverseness in the midst of her, and they have caused Egypt to go astray in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Neither shall there be for Egypt any work which head or tail, palm branch or rush may do. In that day shall the Egyptians be like unto women, and they shall tremble and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he shaketh over them. The words of Isaiah had come true. At the Suez Canal, the British became alarmed at the Egyptian debacle and the possibility of Israeli penetration near the canal. They demanded that the Jews stop or face the British army. In warning, the British sent Spitfire fighters into the sky to gun the Israelis. It seemed only fitting, somehow, that the last shots of the War of Liberation were against the British. The Israeli Air Force brought down 6 British fighter planes. Then Israel yielded to international pressure by letting the Egyptians escape. The shattered Egyptian army regrouped and, with fantastic audacity, marched into Cairo and staged a victory parade. The War of Liberation became history. For months there had been truce talk. For centuries there would be arguments over how it all happened. Experts were confounded and realists were confused. The Arab people of Palestine had long ago accepted the return of the Jews and were prepared to live in peace and benefit from the progress which had been brought after 1,000 sterile years. These people simply did not want to fight and never had. They were betrayed by leaders who were first to run in the time of danger. Their courage was mob frenzy. They were confused by catchphrases they did not understand, much less believe in. They were victimized by racist polemics and filled with a fear of a militant Zionism that never existed. Arab leaders exploited their ignorance for their own willful purposes. Some of the Arabs and their armies fought with valor. Most of them did not. They had been promised easy victories, loot, and rape. They had bolstered each other with a false illusion of Arab unity. Obviously, the cause was not so great it was worth bleeding for. There never was a question of the Jews' willingness to die for Israel. In the end, they stood alone, and with blood and guts won for themselves what had legally been given them by the conscience of the world. And so the Star of David, down for 2,000 years, shone from Eilat to Metula, never to be lowered again. The aftermath of the War of Liberation involved one of the most widely discussed and thorniest dilemmas of the century, the Arab refugee problem. More than 500,000 Palestine Arabs had fled from their homes to neighboring Arab states. All discussions of the disposition of these people became bogged down in furious arguments, accusations, confusion, nationalism, and incrimination. The issue became so involved and mired that it turned into a political time bomb. Barak Ben Kanan was called upon once more to serve his country. The government of Israel asked him to make a complete study of this apparently insolvable situation. He made a painstaking investigation, and his findings filled several hundred pages. In a short summary, Barak shed light on what appeared to be a hopelessly confused problem. Summary of the Arab refugee situation. The most publicized after-event of the War of Liberation has been the Palestine-Arab refugee problem. It has become the most potent political weapon in the Arab arsenal. The Arabs have gone to great lengths to describe the plight of these war victims and to keep the refugee camps as working models to demonstrate to the world Jewish cruelty. Indeed, those who visit these wretched souls are certain to be touched by their plight. The Arabs would have the world believe that the Palestine Arab refugee is unique. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every war man has waged has created refugees, homeless and displaced people. Today, in Europe and Asia, 5 years after the end of World War II, displaced people number in the tens of millions. This is the very nature of war. Had the Arab leaders obeyed the decision of the highest international tribunal and adhered to the law, there would have been no Arab refugee problem. The refugees came as a direct result of a war of aggression waged by the Arabs to destroy the people of Israel. The Arabs created the Palestine refugee problem themselves. After the November 1947 partition vote, the Yishuv of Palestine begged the Palestine Arabs to remain calm, friendly, and to respect the unassailably legal rights of the Jewish people. Despite wanton aggression, the State of Israel, in its Declaration of Independence, held out its hand in friendship to its Arab neighbors, even at the moment her borders were being violated. The avowed intention of murdering the Jewish people and completely destroying the State of Israel was the Arab answer to law and friendship. Strangely, most of the Palestine Arabs fled even before the invasion. Jaffa, Haifa, and the Galilee created most of the refugees, while the fighting was comparatively light. The first reason for this was that the Palestine Arabs were filled with fear. For decades, racist leaders had implanted the idea of mass murder in their minds. These leaders played on the illiteracy, superstition, and fanatical religious devotion of the Fellaheen. These leaders never cared for the Fellaheen, but only for their own personal ambitions. They completely betrayed the people. Blind fear and ignorance caused the first flight of the Arabs. Was this fear founded upon fact? No. At one place, Neve Sadij, there was an unforgivable massacre of innocent people. Otherwise, the Arabs who remained in Palestine were completely unmolested. No Arab village which remained at peace was harmed in any way by the Israelis. In regard to Neve Sadij, we might add that this one example of Jewish excess in the heat of war, one must remember, pales beside the record of scores of Arab-led massacres in over a three-decade period of nominal peace. The second major cause of the refugee situation comes from the absolutely documented fact that the Arab leaders wanted the civilian population to leave Palestine as a political issue and a military weapon. The Arab generals planned an annihilation of the Jewish people. They did not want a large Arab civilian population present to clutter their operational freedom. The politicians wanted to prove Jewish inhumanity by pointing to the Arab refugees forced from their homes. Lastly, the actual fighting helped create part of the refugee situation. Those few Arab villages which fought against the State of Israel were attacked and the Arabs driven from them. No apologies have to be made for this. Documented proof exists that the Arabs were promised they could return to their homes on the heels of Arab victories to loot the destroyed State of Israel. No one can question Arab hostility toward Israel since the war. They have blockaded the Suez Canal in violation of international agreement. They have boycotted business, blackmailed foreign firms, raided border settlements, and constantly threatened to come back for a second attempt to destroy Israel. In the light of this, it is inconceivable that Israel could even consider resettlement of a hostile minority pledged to destroy the state. We come now to the most horrible of all the facts concerning the Arab refugees. The Arab nations do not want these people. They are kept caged like animals in suffering as a deliberate political weapon. In Gaza, to cite one example, the roads are mined and patrolled so that these refugees cannot reach Egypt. The United Nations has established a fund of $200 million for resettlement of the Palestine refugees. There is much lush, fertile, and empty land in the 7 million square miles of the Arab world. The Tigris-Euphrates Valley, one example, has some of the richest unused land in the world, It is inhabited by a handful of Bedouins. This section alone could take not only the 500,000, but 10 million others as well. Not one penny of the resettlement money has been used. On the other hand, Israel, an unfertile land whose 7,000 square miles are half-desert, has taken in more than 500,000 Jewish refugees from Arab countries and stands ready to take in that number again. The Arabs argue that the Palestine refugees themselves do not want to be resettled, but want their farms in Palestine back. This is sheer nonsense. The Arabs have cried crocodile tears over the great love these poor fellaheen have for their lost homes. The fact is, the Palestine fellaheen were victimized by men who used them as a tool, deserted them, and are victimizing them again. Kept penned up, fed with hatred, they are being used to keep Arab hatred of Israel at the boiling point. If the Arabs of Palestine loved their land, they could not have been forced from it, much less run from it without real cause. The Arabs had little to live for, much less to fight for. This is not the reaction of a man who loves his land. A man who loves his land, as the Arabs profess, will stand and die for it. The Arabs tell the world that the state of Israel has expansionist ideas. Exactly how a nation of less than 1 million people can expand against 50 million is an interesting question. The Arab people need a century of peace. The Arab people need leadership, not of desert sheikhs who own thousands of slaves, not of hate-filled religious fanatics, not of military cliques, not of men whose entire thinking is in the Dark Ages. The Arab people need leaders who will bring them civil liberties, education, medicine, land reforms, equality. They need leaders with the courage to face the real problems of ignorance, illiteracy, and disease, instead of waving a ranting banner of ultra-nationalism and promoting the evil idea that the destruction of Israel will be the cure for all their problems. Unfortunately, whenever an enlightened Arab leader arises, he is generally murdered. The Arabs want neither resettlement of the refugees, alleviation of their plight, nor do they want peace. Israel today stands as the greatest single instrument for bringing the Arab people out of the Dark Ages. Only when the Arab people get leadership willing to grasp the hand extended in friendship will they begin to solve the problems which have kept them in moral and physical destitution. Barak Ben Kanan. Book 5. With Wings as Eagles. A voice crieth in the wilderness, Prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength, they shall mount up with wings as eagles. Isaiah. Chapter 1. Nome, Alaska, late 1948. The entire flying stock of the Arctic Circle Airways consisted of 3 Army surplus cargo ships purchased on credit by Stretch Thompson. Stretch had served in Alaska during the war. He had won renown as a young man with a fertile mind and unlimited imagination when it came to devising means of avoiding honest labor. The nights were long in Alaska, and they gave Stretch Thompson much thinking time. Most of his thinking time was devoted to exploiting the untapped riches of Alaska and avoiding honest labor. The longer the nights became, the more Stretch stretched and thought. And one night, he hit it. Crabs. The entire coast was lined with virgin beds of Alaskan king crabs, some 16 inches in diameter. Why, with a little enterprise, he could train the American public to drool for king crabs. In a year, he would make them a delicacy equal to Maine lobsters, Maryland terrapin, or cherry stone clams. He could fly the giant crustaceans down to the United States packed in ice. Eager dealers would snap them up. He would be rich. He would be known as Stretch Thompson, the King Crab King. Things did not work out exactly as Stretch had planned. It appeared that the human race was not advanced enough for his king crabs. The cost of a plane, gas, and a pilot seemed somehow always to come out to more than what he could get for his crabs. Nonetheless, Stretch was not a man to say die. With deft bookwork and glib tongue, he kept the creditors off his back, and he did have an airline, such as it was. With baling wire, spit, and chewing gum, he was able to keep the three crafts of Arctic Circle aloft. Just when things looked the darkest, along came a payload to keep him in business. Stretch's one bit of continued good luck was his chief and sometimes only pilot, Foster J. McWilliams, known as Tex for the usual obvious reason. Foster J. had flown the hump during the war and was, as Stretch put it, the best goddamn chief pilot any goddamn airline ever had. Such was Foster J. McWilliams' prowess that no one in Nome would bet against his setting down a C-47 on the tail end of an iceberg in the middle of a blizzard, drunk. In fact, on various occasions, Stretch tried to raise enough money to make the bet worthwhile, but something always happened. Either the blizzard slackened or Foster couldn't get drunk enough. McWilliams was a tramp. He liked flying. He didn't like the fancy stuff of flying over set routes or with a schedule or with first-class craft. Too dull. The risks of flying Arctic Circle suited him fine. One day McWilliams came into the shack at the end of the runway which served as office, operations headquarters, and home for Stretch Thompson.
"Goddamn, Stretch," he said. "It's colder than a well-digger's ass out there."
Stretch had the look on his face of the proverbial canary-filled cat.
"Foster," he said, "how'd you like to go to a warmer climate and get all of your pay in one bundle? You always did have a gruesome sense of humor."
"I kid you not, Tex. You'll never guess."
"What?"
"Guess."
Foster shrugged.
"You sold the airline."
"That's right." Foster's mouth dropped.